Let's make it happen, Captain!
From deep inside the Death Star, I'm Larry Larson.
And I'm Gov Maharaj.
Welcome to Defrag. What a discussion already today. I wish I could tell people what we just talked about.
It would not be airworthy. Well, no, it could be airworthy, just not for the show.
Yeah, all right. So this is going to be part two, right? We're going to talk about Compat, part two.
Compat,
I'm just going to abbreviate it. Yeah, compatibility.
So, I just love how you put the wrong emphasis on the wrong syllable.
All right. Compat?
Compat.
Okay.
Compat.
Compat. It's compat. Like compact. The computer only. Yeah, compat. But anyway, I don't want to derail you here.
Oh, dude, I got derailed a long time ago.
Yeah, that discussion this morning derailed me. All right, so what are we talking about, Gov?
Okay, so, you know, we talked about general compatibility ideas in the last show. What I wanted to talk about this week is how do you self-assess your compatibility? How do you start to prepare your systems, whether you're an end user or a small business or an enterprise, in order to handle change well? And
yeah,
when I'm saying change, it could be the change of your operating system. It can be the change of upgrades of your existing applications like Office or Exchange or basically anything that you do in your day-to-day life. How do you minimize the questions? How do you minimize the differences and the unexpectedness of the changes that come around?
Yeah, the thing that I'd be wondering too is how do you determine before you start something the issues that you're going to have afterwards?
And that's I want to say it's almost an impossible question to mm-hmm. answer. It isn't impossible, it's just highly improbable.
Yeah.
You can't know with 100% certainty whether or not something will or will not work without testing it.
Mm-hmm.
That's why most migrations take a really, really long time, is that they're having to assess what is currently working. They have to know, okay, what it is that we're going to change out, and then they have to know, how can I keep my existing stuff working while transitioning with the new stuff? Because it's very difficult in anything much larger than a very, very small office to say, okay, we're gonna go down and then we're gonna bring up something brand new in its place and hope everything just works.
Yeah.
You know, you have to generally plan out rollouts, you have to have pilots so that the people that you're serving, you know, your own employees or your customers are they're able to test it out. They're able to see, you know, does this do the thing that I expect it to do versus doesn't it not do what I expect it to do?
Mm-hmm.
And this is what we have with all of our betas, right? Like,
yeah,
we give out the OS in a beta form so that people can try it out and they can tell us, you know, what types of issues they're having, and we can attempt to address them. Now, some things we can address in the OS itself and some things we can't address in the OS because it's not necessarily the OS's fault. There's different faces to a bug, or a different face to issues that you might see. So if you have, OS A, and you have application A, it seemingly works together, mm-hmm. right? Like, it's doing what you expect it to do. The app starts up, you're able to open a file, print the file, save the file, exit, everything seems to work okay. Now, depending on how this app was created, it could be relying on bugs in the operating system in order to do what it is expecting to do.
Mm-hmm.
So you upgrade the operating system or you get a patch for some fix, and suddenly the app isn't doing what you expect it to do anymore. And you rightfully, or at least immediately, blame the operating system because that's the thing that changed.
Yeah.
However, you have to kind of look at it in terms of, yes, something has changed that made my app not work, but is the fact that my app not working the OS's fault? What could the app have done? Like, best case scenarios, what is the most ideal thing? The ideal thing is that the app would not be relying on a bug, and the OS, having fixed that bug, should not have broken the OS or the application.
Yeah.
So, for those types of problems, they're usually pretty difficult to understand without debugging them. What we have done in the OS is basically said, it's not the customer's fault that their application is buggy or that the OS exposed a bug in the application.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not saying that the OS is completely bug-free. It's not. We're human beings. We're engineers. We produce, we don't consciously produce bugs, but, you know, bugs creep in because we can't possibly test all configurations.
Yeah.
You know, there are literally millions of applications out in the wild. We cannot test them all in all configurations, on all hardware, in all scenarios,
well, the other
in order
thing
to find all the bugs.
The other thing that I've heard as well is there's times where you, when you're making an operating system, you're like, okay, if I make choice A, it's going to segment this amount of people who are going to have a problem. And if I make choice B, it's going to have this other one. Which one is bigger? Which one is going to cause more problems?
Exactly.
And you have to do it one way or the other.
It's commonly referred to as the 80-20 rule. Mm-hmm. You know, you want to satisfy 80% of your customers 80% of the time. 20% of your customers 20% of your time may not work correctly. Now, for us, that number is not what we use at all.
Yeah.
80-20 is far too big a divide.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
We're generally looking at the 99.999.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah.
We have an immensely high bar from compatibility, but due to the nearly exponential and unlimited configurations out there, even a 5.9 scenario still has a lot of customers and a lot of scenarios that are uncovered in that 0.001 percent.
Yeah.
So what we've done in the operating system over the years is we try not to penalize our customers for bugs in the application. Mm-hmm. We have tools, compatibility tools, and I've talked about a few of them in the past. Our main one that is available for customers and enterprises is Compatibility Administrator. This exposes the shims that we've produced in the operating system that you can apply to different applications in order to attempt to get them to keep working. So what shims are pieces of code that get inserted into the process that change the application behavior to what it, to one that it expects.
Yeah.
You know, so for the apps that have relied on bugs in the OS or in implementations, for example, one would be heap corruptions. Double freeze of the heap. Applications will routinely rely on a piece of memory that has been freed but has not been garbage collected, it has not been overwritten yet. But the OS has said, you know, this is no longer your memory. You're not allowed to use it. But apps do that. You know, double free issues are relatively common. And the reason why over time they creep up more and more frequently is because of memory constrained situations. You know, we want to get the operating system as lean and as fast as possible.
Sure.
So we compress and we collect that memory a lot faster than we ever did before. So when applications touch that piece of memory, they will access violate, they'll crash. So we have different fixes in the shim database, for example, like specifically the heaps. You know, heap clear allocation, heap delay local free, heap force global, heap ignore movable, heap look aside free, heap pad allocation, heap validate freeze. All of these are heap shims that we use in order to handle very particular scenarios where the heap has been corrupted.
Yeah.
This allows the app to keep working, but don't get me wrong, the heap is still corrupted. It just kind of hides the issue. Or, for example, the heap pad allocation, what that will do is when you're asking for memory on the heap and there's a known overwrite at the end, for example, we'll pad the allocation so that when you say, hey, give me 1K of memory, we'll actually give you 2K of memory, or 1.5K, I don't exactly remember the memory size of the allocation. So that when you overwrite your buffer of 1K, you're not actually overwriting the next buffer of 1K that would be allocated by something else.
Yeah.
You're overwriting your additional pad. You're overwriting what you should have called in the first place, right? So a lot of our fixes are things that the app could have easily done to fix themselves. And we have a lot of shims. Some are still relevant today. Many are not. The vast majority of these shims were created in the XP timeframe to handle Win9X conversion into the XP land.
So are all these system-wide or any of them like devoted to a particular application?
So these are all of the general shims that we have available. So if you apply, for example, what's a good one? Some of these names are kind of interesting. They're really designed to make sense to the people that are applying it, not necessarily to an end user that is trying to apply it.
And as a developer, how well do you need to know about these shims? Is it something that you can just, it's just transparent and you don't have to worry about it? Or should you know what these shims are doing?
Actually, that is a phenomenally awesome question
to ask. That's what I ask.
I am extremely glad you asked that question. As a developer of an application, I would really want to know the shims that are applied to my application.
Yeah.
By the OS and by individuals, although the ones that are applied by individuals are not necessarily as informative. Mm-hmm. You can see what shims are being applied to your process by checking the environment, by checking the event log. It'll tell you which shims are being applied. Generally, we apply layers to applications. It's also fairly easy just to contact us and we'll tell you, you know, what shims we've applied to your application. Mm-hmm. We'll tell you what's wrong. Generally, when we do fixes, we notify the ISV so that they can fix themselves in the future. The thing that we don't want to have happen is for an application to be forever shimmed, right? We want the actual application to get fixed, but what we understand is that not all of them can be fixed. Mm-hmm. So yeah, it is very important to know what shims have been applied so that you can get out from under them. Some of them tend to be, you know, pretty benign. You know, some you may never really be able to fix. But, you know, for example, in the Vista timeframe, we applied the run as administrator shim for a large number of setups and applications so that they would not fail. They would actually get the UAC security prompt so that users would say, oh, okay, this app is now prompting me. I'm going to have to hit either yes or no, and it will work, albeit in an elevated context.
Yeah,
that was a move that we did to force ISVs to say, hey, you need to fix your setup or you need to fix your runtime so that you're using the permissions properly, so that users don't have to see this prompt. It was especially annoying for users, and I understand it, if every single time you wanted to run your application, you got this dialogue prompt.
It also
made it so that standard users couldn't run the application. Now, to be fair, they couldn't ever run the application, even in XP, if they were a standard user. Mm-hmm. All UAC did was bring it to the user's attention that, hey, we're going to be using your administrative privileges here. You need them in order for this app to continue functioning.
Yeah.
So that was one of the shims that we applied. We spent a great deal of time applying shims to applications in the Vista timeframe so that they would prompt for admin in order to keep working. Now, most of these are documented in, you know, some way, shape, or form, usually as a KB article. You can create, through Compat Admin, you can apply any of these shims to your process yourself. So as an end user, you can create what we call a custom SDB, a custom database, that can apply these to an executable if you're having problems and you've debugged it to the point where you know which one of these should work. Mm-hmm. Now, generally speaking, you don't want to just dive into the compatibility fixes. What you kind of want to look at are the compatibility modes. These are layers. These encompass different shims. So, for example, the 16-bit color layer has force display mode with a command line of 16-bit. The fault-tolerant heap is one of our newer layers that took those heap shims that I was talking about, basically upgraded them to be much more intelligent. This is an automatic layer that is applied when applications are run. If they crash, and we detect why they crashed, because crashes have a certain signature, and we basically are able to look at the crashing event, and we look at that event and say, okay, did we crash because of a heap issue? If that happens three times, this layer will kick in, because we don't necessarily want it for a one-time only thing. We need to actually know that it is something that's going to happen, you know, repeatedly.
Yeah.
Because the fault-tolerant heap can, in some cases, make things worse. So if it's a one-time heap corruption only, we may not want to apply that layer to it. But if it happens repeatedly, then we'll apply the layer and hopefully things will continue working. Mm-hmm. That's one of the improvements that was made, I believe, in Wind 7, was to enable this fault-tolerant heap. And you can go through and you can see certain layers, for example, you know, emulate sorting Windows 6.1, that's for Wind 7. This changes sorting behavior for the natural language system, mm-hmm. how word breaking works, how sorting works in it. Certain things like databases, when they index their database, might need the older sorting methods, or else you'd have to re-index the entire database as you move to the next OS. And sorting methods change on OS to OS because of new compliance reasons that happen due to like world agreements. Mm-hmm. So sorting values change, but we don't necessarily want to screw up databases. Some of them are sensitive to sorting algorithm changes. So this is one tool that I hope people will actually take a look at. Not necessarily create SDBs willy-nilly, but if you actually encounter an application where something like, you know, just the version lie layer, if you're running on Vista, Win 7, or Win 8, you can try them out. You know, these are our version layers. Something that people may have noticed in Windows 8.1 is that if you call the getVersion API, you're actually going to get back, in a number of cases, the Windows 8 version. You won't get back 6.3, you'll get back 6.2. Mm-hmm. That was something that we did as kind of like a final stake in the ground that's saying, you know, we don't want people checking the version. One of the major, major problems over the years, and we've devoted essentially 70% of my team's time every single release to this, is taking applications that worked on the previous version of the OS, trying it on the latest version of the OS, having it pop a message saying, we don't know about you, so we're not going to run.
Yeah.
Right? And then we shim them. It doesn't really help anybody to have these kinds of messages. The customer is annoyed. We have to go and shim them anyways so that the app will function, and we know that it will function. And we test it to ensure that it continues to work. Mm-hmm. So what we did was we basically blanketed, and we said, look, if you're calling the getVersion API, unless you've manifested, and this is a marking a resource that you can put in your executable, unless you've manifested knowing that you are on 8.1, you will get back the previous version of the OS. This is the same thing that we've done over the course of many, many years with the version lie layers. Yeah. It's just now we've done it on a much more grander scale, and we've actually been able to save that 70% of the time. Like, the cost-benefit analysis for this was an immense amount of benefit versus the cost. Mm-hmm. To some applications that were perhaps logging the version number, which, you know, is of questionable usefulness.
Yeah.
So that particular change is basically said, you know, don't do a version check for the thing that you're looking for. Actually look for the thing that you're looking for.
Yeah.
Have rich logging in your application. And this kind of goes back to application design I was talking about in the last episode, mm-hmm. is you want to make your application as compatible as possible. That doesn't just mean having it work on all existing operating systems, but having it work on future operating systems, right? It means not putting barriers in place for your application to not work on a future OS. One of the things that you kind of have to internalize as a developer is that the OS is not out to break you.
Yes.
Our main goal is to have your application work on the next version and future versions of the OS. Mm-hmm. The way that we do that, API contracts, documentation, right? So when we have something documented as saying, you know, it will work this way, we will really, really make certain that that continues to work that way. Otherwise, we'll create a new API. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, we make it opt-in. You know, you have to call another function in order to get the new behavior, or we mark it as a new parameter to the API. Like, we do various different things so that existing callers don't break. We take that very, very seriously.
I think the first time we shot, you talked about, it wasn't on camera, but we were talking afterwards, and you were talking about how you wanted to do just a show on check version because developers don't tend to do that the right way.
They
and now I see why. You spend 70% of your time.
And this is not just me. This is a team of about 8 people.
Yeah.
That are spending 70% of their time across a development cycle. That is hundreds and thousands of man hours.
Yeah.
And that's not touching the millions of applications out there. Mm-hmm. That's only touching the, 2,000 to 5,000 applications that we test.
Yeah.
Right? So with the change that I made in 8.1, and that was my change, you can blame me if you like, but I stick by it. That is now affecting the millions of apps that mm-hmm. could never have been affected before.
Yeah.
Right? That is an instant win for compatibility. Mm-hmm. And again, yes, some folks have had issues with that. And we say, for those folks that have had an issue with that, manifest your application, and then you'll get back the real version number for that OS. Mm-hmm. So you had a pre-Win8 or a Win8 application.
Metal Moraines, Windows 3.1 app. I still try to run it.
Yes, but that one's not calling for the OS version.
Yeah. Yeah. And it worked on XP, but...
Right, I have to get that. I have to see if I can get that working for you again. But if you have an application and you needed to get the particular version number, the actual number on 8.1, you have to manifest it.
Yeah.
And it will only work on 8.1. When the next version comes out, you will have to manifest it again if you actually require it. Otherwise, what we actually want you to use are version helper APIs. And I don't actually have the page up here, but we can just do a quick search. Version helper functions. Okay. We actually want you to use these functions to say whether or not you're supported. Is Windows 8.1 or greater, right? Mm-hmm. Then you can say, you'll get back a bool and say yes or no, and you make your decision based on the lowest version of the OS that you support, not the highest version.
Yeah.
You should not be doing version checks in a case statement that goes, okay, case 5, case 6, case 7, 7 doesn't exist, and then default is being, oh, I must be Win95. Mm-hmm. Like, no, what is actually more probable? That you're running on an OS that hasn't been run for the past 10 years or longer, or that it's a future in development OS. Mm-hmm. It's far more likely that you're running on a future in development OS and that everything that you're using, if it's documented, should just work. So that was the compat admin. You can create fixes. You can create app helps. Now, app helps are those messages that you see that try to inform the user that, there's two different types of app helps. Let me back up a little bit. Two different types of app helps. One is a soft block, one's a hard block. Soft block will allow you to keep running the application, but it'll pop up a message. And it'll basically give you some information, like perhaps you need to apply a patch in order for it to work correctly mm-hmm. With the new operating system. We use this method for end users, and enterprises like to use this in order to help direct users to newer versions of the application, ones that fix issues. The other type of the hard block, basically informs you of the problem and does not allow you to run the application because of potential catastrophic data loss or machine bug check style things that would happen to your machine if it was still allowed to run. Mm-hmm. We hard block things like executables and drivers specifically so that your machine is kept as stable as possible.
Yeah.
We don't do it willy-nilly. It's actually pretty difficult to get a hard block in place, and we always try to point the user on how to get out of it. This is what we call our path to goodness. Mm-hmm. Not necessarily grammatically correct, but it has a nice ring to it.
Yeah.
So all of these things you can use and deploy in your enterprise along with an application, for example. You can deploy a custom SDB as you install an application so that it will apply particular shim for it. We use this as a stopgap measure. We don't want to, in perpetuity, perpetuate it, because the shims, like any piece of code, when designed for a particular operating system, may not be relevant on the newest operating system. Mm-hmm. For example, there is a shim here. Won't be there, won't be under compatibility mode, it'll be under fixes. emulate heap. Okay. That emulates the 9x heap on NT.
That's helpful.
Yeah, and that actually was actually really helpful in porting over 9x apps into NT because the heap was drastically different. Mm-hmm. However, the 9x implementation today will still cause you problems.
Yeah.
We designed it so that, you know, so the full 9x heap implementation so that it would work within the XP's heap implementation. But since the heap implementation has changed, even emulate heap nowadays is, you know, not necessarily going to cause you more problems, but it may not actually do what you want it to do all the time.
Yeah.
And it's kind of the main issue that we have in running really, really old code that even is correctly documented. Like even the best perfect documented old code may not work in the exact same scenarios that we have today. Because the scenarios today are vastly different than what we had before. Your game, for example, your Windows 3.1 game, had no concept necessarily of a networked system, right? It may not have any idea of a resolution beyond 640 by 480.
Yeah.
So, you know, it may not know what to do with a higher resolution. It may make assumptions that, oh, there could not possibly be a resolution higher than 640 by 480.
It's even more screwed up than that because Metal Marines will open two windows, mm-hmm. the enemy's window and yours, and you send missiles across it and they go across your desktop. So there's a lot of stuff going on that I'm sure doesn't work the same anymore.
Right. So again, that's an interesting type of game. I don't think I've ever heard of this game, but I was never really a big gamer. Could be relying on particular quirks of the operating system that for whatever reason, just due to age, due to not testing it, because again, we can't test every possible scenario, does not necessarily make it forward.
Yeah.
We've rewritten stacks over the years so that implementation details are not necessarily maintained because they just can't be maintained. You know, quirks of the compiler will have a particular type of side effect that is not easily maintained or even possible to maintain going forward. Mm-hmm. So things of that issue where you even if you do things perfectly right, you can't guarantee that something that is really, really old will necessarily work forever.
Yeah.
But we try to minimize that as much as possible. So this is the tool that we produce, CompatAdmin. It is by no means the end-all be-all of the AppCompat toolkit. There are other parts of the AppCompat toolkit that you can deploy in your enterprise, agents for application inventory. But again, like I said, that's not the only one. There are other ones created by third parties. For example, AppDNA, which has apparently been purchased by Citrix, which is something I was not aware of. Don't really care one way or the other. But this has additional agents. It works by this similar premise of going out, inventorying systems, and trying to figure out, based on the operating system that you're going to, what types of markers do we need to look for in order to say, hey, you're going to have you have a probability of having an issue. Mm-hmm. One of the things that I remember about this, and again, it's kind of older information, but is relevant for those still on XP trying to move forward, is it would look for features of applications, for example, that relied on admin privileges. And one of the things that it would do is say, hey, you know, you have a risk assessment. This is utilizing something that requires admin privileges. It may not work in the same way. You might have to repackage your application. Other ones are, you know, this ACL is incorrect. Or you're using the 16-bit OCX. It is not available. Moving to the 64-bit version of the OS, you may want to address that. This tool, AppDNA, ChangeBase is another one that does something very similar. Both of these tools are there to help your assessment of your application to see what it is that you have that you should go put a magnifying glass on and say, well, what are my choices here? The best choice whenever you have a compat problem is, do I need this anymore? Like, if you can just get rid of it and it's not part of your work stream anymore, then great. You don't have to worry about trying to make it work. Mm-hmm. If you can start whittling that down to the things that are absolutely essential, and you go through, well, you know, what are my workflows? And you have to understand what your workflows are at every point in the year. Like, for example, and I've seen this happen a lot in accounting, where something is only ever used once at year end, right? And if you do your assessment in December, for example, and I'm talking about fiscal year end, but if you do your assessment in December, then you may not be cognizant of that one thing that has to work, right? Mm-hmm. So you really want to, there's the automated method using these tools, but there's also the personal method of going to department heads, going to the actual line workers, people that are using this stuff on a daily basis, and say, like, over the course of a year, just start recording the kinds of things that you have to do.
Yeah.
And you do this continually. Like, for an assessment of a migration, one of the reasons why it takes so long is because people wait to do it, right? They wait and they wait and they wait, and a new OS releases, and they go, okay, well, now I want to go to it. Well, then now they spend a year and a half on doing their assessment in order to actually move to it, and by that time, another OS will come out. And they kind of feel like they're being left behind. Mm-hmm. One of the ways around this, or at least to help mitigate this, is to constantly be doing your self-assessment. Basically, tell yourself, if at any point in time I had to make a major change, what would it take for me to do it? Mm-hmm. Like, how agile am I at making changes? So I suggest, as an end user, all the way up through an enterprise, is to continually self-assess and say, what is it that I'm doing? What is it that I'm relying upon? If my business, or if this particular thing did not work, how quickly could I switch? What are my options? You know, that kind of thing. How do I encapsulate the things that I'm doing? And then that automatically becomes things like your pilot projects. You know, the people that you're talking to are going to be the ones that are like, hey, can you try this out? You know, and you can do a lot of different things by setting up a virtual machine, for example, that they can log into and test things out and say, yes, this works, no, it doesn't work, hey, this needs to be tweaked, and then, you know, that feedback can be given.
Awesome.
I think we're basically at the end.
Yeah.
One of the tools, our pick of the week this week, my pick of the week, I don't really have a lot of those usually, is Emmet. And
I was going to say EMET, but that makes perfect sense that you would actually have a word for it.
I don't like saying acronyms.
Yeah.
The Enhanced Mitigation Experience Toolkit, this is a security tool that allows enterprises primarily, but again, there's fundamentally nothing saying an end user can't use it, mm-hmm. To mitigate zero-day issues in products, in basically anything. It is generally used a lot more in IE because IE is internet facing and is a very attractive target. But this helps protect processes by applying essentially shims and patches to the processes to either nullify the issue without drastically impacting your business. So for example, we may have large knife switches in the operating system to turn something off where you know, you're being impacted. But in throwing that large knife switch, you could be impacting and hindering your business. What Emmet allows you to do is change that large knife switch into a much smaller knife switch, targeting your surface area better. Mm-hmm. So you're not carpet bombing, you're, you know, using a surgical strike. So this tool is very cool. It is, again, not perfect by any stretch of the imagination, because no tool ever is. But it allows you to react very quickly to threats and to basically cover yourself while we're producing and testing a complete fix. Mm-hmm. So this allows you to take on some of the risk by saying, okay, I am going to go do something. I'm going to pull down a signature, an Emmet signature, to help protect me. Now, you're doing that knowing full well that it could break you. You're taking compatibility risk while doing it. It is not a risk that we are willing to make for you. Right? What we want to do is create a fix, test the fix, and ensure that it does not cause compatibility problems, which is why Emmet fixes are not, absolutely not identical to the fixes that we come out with in the OS. But this gives you a really good, you know, chainmail armor across issues that might be coming across, that might be hitting very hard and very quickly. So I recommend people take a look at it. Its latest version of Emmet should be available on Windows 8. I don't believe it is certified yet for 8.1.
Okay.
But it should be very soon.
Awesome. All right, and that's the show for this week. If you have questions, you can write us at defragshow@microsoft.com, and we'll see you next week.
Take care.